February 20th, 1933. It's when Hermann Göring, which Hitler's a right-hand man, summons 22 dozen of Germany's wealthiest and most powerful industrialist financiers and executives. In the invitation that is sent per telegram, it is promised to these men that Hitler, the new chancellor, is going to explain his economic policies to these men. But nothing could be further from the truth. What it actually the entire meeting is about is a fundraise meeting for a Nazi party which is completely broke, and both Hitler and Göring in their speeches to the men very explicitly promise that this is going to be the last election that is going to happen in 10 or 100 years in Germany. So they very explicitly promise the end of German democracy.
ברוכים הבאים למרקרים, פודקאסט סוף השבוע של דה מרקר. הזדמנות שלכם לקחת בזק זמן ממחזור החדשות היומיומי ולצלול איתנו לאירועים, לאנשים ובעיקר לרעיונות מאחורי החדשות. כאן באולפן איתכם כמדי שבוע, ענת ג'ורג'י וגיא רולניק. שלום ענת.
שלום גיא.
שמענו בפתיח את דייוויד דה ג'ונג, עיתונאי כלכלי ומחבר הספר המיליארדרים הנאצים.
גיא, זה טובת המאזינים שלנו נאמר שאתה בארצות הברית, ורציתי לשאול אותך איך היה לצאת מישראל בימים האלה, או במילים אחרות, כמה שעות עמדת בתור בנתב"ג?
טוב, זו תשובה קצת מסובכת. אני טסתי לארצות הברית הפעם דרך פריז באייר פרנס, ואייר פרנס מאפשרים לעשות צ'ק אין דרך האינטרנט. עכשיו, אני תמיד טס בלי מזוודה, אלא רק עם מזוודה קטנה שאני עולה למטוס, אז אני לא עומד בתור הארוך של הצ'ק-אין, אבל היום בנתב"ג יש תור אחר, חדש, למי שאין לו מזוודה, של מין משהו כמו כזה קדם ביטחון. עכשיו, זה תור בערך עכשיו של רבע שעה עד חצי שעה, תלוי מתי באים. אחרי זה, כמובן, יש את התור של הביטחון הרגיל, שזה נניח חצי שעה עד שעה. לעומת זאת, הבת שלי טסה לארצות הברית כמה שעות לפניי דרך מדריד. עכשיו, איבריה לא מאפשרים לעשות משום צ'ק-אין באינטרנט, גם למי שאין לו מזוודה. וזה כבר יוצר סיוט ארוך, כי אז צריך לעמוד בצ'ק-אין, וזה יכול להגיע לשעה, שעתיים, שלוש. השורה התחתונה היא שהגעתי עם הבת שלי לשדה התעופה באחת לפנות בוקר, והמראתי לפריז באיחור של שעה ב-8 בבוקר. אז כן, 7 שעות בשדה התעופה במקרה הזה.
גיא, זה נשמע כמו בעיה לפתרון במתמטיקה לבגרות. גיא יצא באחד דרך פריז, הבת שלו יצא דרך מדריד, ושניהם התקיעו בדרך. אבל אני רוצה לשאול אותך, מי השם? אתה תמיד אוהב לנעוץ את החצים שלך באשמים, אז אם זאת מרב מיכאלי, הנהלת רשות שדות התעופה, ועד העובדים ברשות פנחס סידן.
כן, תראי, קודם כל נתחיל מזה, יש עוד הרבה שדות תעופה בעולם שהמצב בהם די מזעזע. בהית'רו בלונדון למשל, הוא נראה ממש כמו גן חיות בחודשיים האחרונים, אבל ישראל עדיין נמנית על שדות התעופה הגרועים יותר בעולם, וזה לא חדש. עוד עניין מעניין הוא מה שמאפיין את נתב"ג לעומת שדות התעופה ברוב העולם, הוא איזה מידה של שוויוניות. כי בעוד שברוב השדות התעופה יש צ'ק-אין ובידוק נפרד לנוסעים במחלקות עסקים, ושם כמובן התורים הרבה יותר קצרים, אז בישראל מאז הקורונה כולם עומדים באותו תור. כלומר, שוויוניות וזה נחמד. אבל השוויוניות הזאת היא קצת מטעה, מדוע? כי מי שבאמת יש לו כסף לשרוף בלי בעיה, קונה בנתב"ג מה שקוראים את שירות ה-VIP, שהוא מאוד יקר, יכול להגיע לאלפי שקלים, ואז הוא עוקף את כל התורים.
אתה יודע, אני הייתי אמורה לטוס עם הבן שלי לטיול בר מצווה בקיץ, והחלטתי לדחות את זה, מהרבה מאוד סיבות, גם כי כרטיסים נורא יקרים, וגם בגלל
המחיר של הכרטיסים עלה ב-50 עד 100%
בחודשיים האחרונים. מטורף, כן. נכון? וגם בגלל שבאמת תמיד עמוס בנתב"ג בקיץ, נכון שעכשיו זה באמת מקרה מיוחד, ובכל העולם זה ככה, אבל בנתב"ג תמיד עמוס בקיץ, ובין היתר זה עמוס כי בניגוד להרבה מאוד ערים אחרות בעולם, אין שדה תעופה חלופי. היחיד שהם בנו הוא ברמון, שהוא שדה מהמם, הייתי שם לפני חודשיים, רק אפשר להגיע אליו, כי קו הרכבת לאילת שעליו מדברים 50 שנה לא יוצא, וכנראה גם לא יצא לדרך, ושדה תעופה אחר שרצו להקים ברמת דוד, מרב מיכאלי לפני חצי שנה בעצם, ביטלה את החלטת הממשלה, והחליטה להקים, כמו שתמיד השרים אוהבים, איזושהי ועדה מקצועית שתבחן את החלופות. אז למרות שכולם יודעים שנתב"ג עמוס, ולמרות שכולם ברור שהוא ימשיך ויהיה עוד הרבה יותר עמוס, למעשה בעוד 9 שנים הוא יגיע, במקרה הטוב, לקצה גבול הקיבולת שלו, אין שום חלופות. אז מה שאנחנו רואים כרגע כמצב חריג, מהר מאוד יהפוך להיות מצב קבוע, ולא רק בקיץ.
זה די מזעזע. אבל את יודעת, ענת, בדיון על מה שקורה בשדה התעופה, נתב"ג, יש אולי היבט נוסף חשוב, והוא סוג השיחה שיש בנושא, שאת קוראת ברשתות החברתיות ולפעמים בעיתונים, את רואה תמיד איך מנסים מיד לדחוף את הדיון, כמו שפתחת אגב, לביבי או לא ביבי, כלומר, ביביסטים אומרים לנו שבתורים האלה כמובן אשמה ממשלת השינוי, ואלה שבמחנה רק לא ביבי אומרים שבתקופת ביבי המצב היה הרבה יותר גרוע, ובכלל התורים עכשיו נובעים מהסגסוג הכלכלי בעידן ממשלת השינוי, או ממדיניות הקורונה שלה, ואנחנו רואים שוב ושוב שיש יכולת כל כך מוגבלת לנהל דיון ענייני היום שלא הופך מיד למחנאי.
אוקיי, גיא, אני חושבת שהנושא הרבה יותר מורכב מזה, ובשבוע שעבר כתבת בחריפות אפילו נגד ממשלת השינוי, ואני בניגוד אליך חושבת שהם כן עשו הרבה דברים טובים בשנה האחרונה, כן היה איזו תחושה לפחות, שבניגוד לשנים הקודמות, שיש כן איזושהי נכונות לעבוד לטובתנו.
קודם כל, כדאי לזכור שהרוב המכריע של קוראי הארץ ודמרקר, ממילא לא יצביעו בשום מצב, עבור נתניהו ושותפיו הפוטנציאליים. כלומר, אם יש לנו, וככל שיש לנו בדמרקר השפעה כלשהי, היא בעיקר על המחנה של המרכז והשמאל. אבל ענת, מה שיותר חשוב הוא שלמרות שחלק ניכר מהקוראים שלנו רוצים שנתעלם מהמחדלים של ממשלת השינוי, כי עכשיו המטרה העליונה היא למנוע את חזרתו של נתניהו, עם כל הסכנות הכרוכות בחזרה של נתניהו למוסדות הדמוקרטיים. אני חושב שזאת עמדה שגויה גם טקטית, גם אסטרטגית ובוודאי עיתונאית. כלומר, גם אם יש עיתונאי או עורך שסבור שההתנהגות של נתניהו כמוני בשנים האחרונות מהווה סכנה ברורה ומיידית למוסדות דמוקרטיים ולנורמות השלטון, עדיין העיתונאי חייב להמשיך לבקר את מחדלי ממשלת השינוי.
זה ברור, אבל אתה לא מסכים שהיא כן ניסתה לעשות יותר בשנה האחרונה? אתה יודע, הייתה בסך הכל שנה בשלטון. יש פה ראש ממשלה שזאת הייתה פעם ראשונה שהוא נכנס למקום הזה בכלל, ועבדו תחת אופוזיציה שעשתה הכל כדי להכשיל אותה.
כן, אבל אני חושב שלקחת את העמדה שאנחנו משווים את הממשלה הנוכחית כל הזמן לנתניהו, זה עמדה מאוד גרועה, שאנחנו בעצם נותנים איזה פטור ופס לממשלה הזאת. אני רוצה לחזור, לא רק שזה מתבקש עיתונאית, אלא גם ענת זה קריטי כדי שראשי ממשלת השינוי ידעו שגם הם תחת ביקורת ואין להם חסינות רק משום שהם החלופה היחידה לנתניהו. עכשיו תראי, ביקורת על ממשלת השינוי לא באמת מחזקת את נתניהו, כאשר היא מלווה בקונטקסט הרחב של מעשיו בעשור האחרון, כמו שאת אמרת. אבל אם אנחנו לא רוצים למצוא את עצמנו יום אחד עם פוליטיקאים מהמחנה השני שמאמצים בהדרגה את כל הנורמות של נתניהו, אנחנו חייבים לבקר אותם בנחישות. וממשלת השינוי הזאת נכשלה ונכשלת בשורה ארוכה של פעולות ושל מינויים וצעדי מדיניות די תמוהים. אבל הפתיח האקטואלי הארוך הזה הוא רק הקדמה לפודקאסט שלנו היום, שהוא שונה מהרגיל בשבועות ובחודשים האחרונים. היום אנחנו חוזרים כמעט 90 שנה לאחור. אנחנו נשארים כהרגלנו עם פוליטיקה וכסף, עם שלטון ומיליארדרים, נושאים חביבים עלינו כאן במרקרים, אבל הולכים לתקופה אחרת לחלוטין, לשנות ה-30 של המאה הקודמת בגרמניה, ערב עלייתו של אדולף היטלר לשלטון. הרקע לשיחה היום הוא ספר חדש, מרתק, שראה אור לפני כחודשיים, המיליארדרים הנאצים, נאצי ביליונרס, שכתב העיתונאי הכלכלי דיוויד ג'ונג. דיוויד נמצא בימים אלה בישראל, ויכל להגיע לאולפננו בתל אביב.
כן, אז כפי שנראה מיד, הספר עוסק באמת בתקופה אחרת לחלוטין, אבל השאלות שהוא מעלה על כסף ושלטון רלוונטיות מאוד גם להיום. ההיסטוריה של עליית הנאציזם שלובה לא רק במשבר הכלכלי, השפל הגדול או הסכמי ורסאי המשפילים שלאחר מלחמת העולם הראשונה, אלא גם בתפקיד שמילאו ברוני הכסף, חברות הענק הגרמניות. הרעיון הוא כמובן באנגלית, אז מיד מתחילים. Hello, David. Welcome to our studio in Tel Aviv.
Hello, Anat. Hello, Guy. It's great to be here. Toda rabah.
Before we jump to your book, tell us a bit about yourself. You are a financial journalist and you have a Dutch name.
That is correct. I was born and raised in Amsterdam. I just moved to Tel Aviv last week. I'm going to be here for 4 years to be the Middle Eastern correspondent for the Dutch Financial Daily. And prior to that, I was living in Berlin for 4 years, where I researched and wrote the book, Nazi Billionaires. And before that, I was eight years in New York, 6 years of which I was working for Bloomberg News, reporting on family-owned companies. And it's where the idea for my book, Nazi Billionaires, began.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. Writing a book about Nazis Germany is quite an undertaking. What brought you into this?
When I started working for Bloomberg News in late 2011, I started on a team which was a new investigative team which investigated hidden wealth and family-owned companies and non-stock exchange listed family-owned companies, but also the family office space. And I was actually hired to cover North America, but they soon asked me if I could cover the German-speaking countries because I'm Dutch. And what I would do is I would spend 1 month a year in the Bloomberg bureaus in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. And the stories I came back with were, you know, a mix of the financial and the historical, of business and history. But what struck me was that, you know, Germany's wealthiest business families today, the families that control BMW and Volkswagen and Audi and such global brands, you know, they celebrate the business successes of their fathers and grandfathers, designed the first Porsche sports car or saved BMW from bankruptcy through global foundations and media prizes and academic chairs. But they never mention their war crimes, their Nazi war crimes, anywhere. So I was struck by this very blatant whitewashing of history. And that is really the reason why I started writing the book and why I moved to Germany to write the book, to really investigate how Germany's richest, wealthiest business families today, how they got involved with the Hitler regime and profited from it and got away with it and are covering that history up today.
Yeah, you are basically targeting your arrows at people, not the corporation. I guess it was intentional.
Yes, those families that control BMW. It's those families that control the Volkswagen Group, which not only includes Volkswagen and Porsche, but also Audi and Bentley and Lamborghini. And the BMW Group also includes not only BMW, but also Mini and Rolls-Royce. And it's the families that co-founded Allianz and Munich Re. It's the families that are the controlling shareholders of these companies. It's not the companies itself that, I mean, they plenty of executives also.
It's a good enemy.
Crimes,
but, talk about
indeed.
People.
Yeah, that as well. Yeah.
So, David, we're now almost 80 years after the end of World War II. And one would think that the issue of connection between big business and the Nazis is already well covered by historians and journalists in previous work. But as I recall, when I did some research on antitrust in Nazi Germany a couple of years ago, I was surprised that there are some very, it's true, there are some very good books, but compared to other issues about World War II, the number of books is still small. Is this correct?
So something I recognized when I got the book idea back in 2014, I saw that there was a vacuum, or a knowledge vacuum, in a sense that, yes, you had academic books. The most well-known is perhaps Henry Ashby Turner's book, The Rise of Big Business and the Nazi Regime, but it was from the mid-1980s, and it only covers the period up until Hitler seizes power in early 1933, the 12 years afterwards is barely covered. And then you have Adam Tooze's famous book, The Wages of Destruction, which focuses really on the economic aspects, like more of the structural aspects. And it's also an academic book as opposed to a journalistic book. So for a general audience, these are still quite inaccessible books. And I wanted to write a book which everyone in the world could read and access.
So let's dive in. Three first quick questions. One, how instrumental were the German tycoons in Adolf Hitler's takeover of Germany? What were the world? Could he have done it without their help? Did they have any choice other than support him? And lastly, does your research on these issues in line with the most historians?
To your first question, Germany's established big business did not really want, bar a few exceptions, didn't really want that much to do with Hitler before he seized power. The first contacts between Germany's big businessmen or the families I write about and the Nazi Party really only happened after he seized power in January 1933, that they really started to collaborate in a way. And what you see in September 1930, after the Great Depression starts and you have Black Friday on Wall Street, you know, Germany has mass unemployment, and on the back of that, in September 1930, in a campaign led by Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi Party becomes the second party in German parliament. It is that electoral victory that opens the door for Hitler and the Nazi Party to Germany's established big business. Because before that, they viewed Hitler and the Nazi Party as a bunch of clowns, you know, from the impoverished hinterlands. But now that they had power, they were interested. So it is in those 2.5 years between the Nazi Party's first electoral success in September 1930 and him seizing power in January 1933 that you see the first contacts between Germany's big business and Hitler. But they don't support him yet. That really happens after he is in power and he's chancellor, and they have no choice but to work with him, and they fall in line.
David, you focus in your book on two very wealthy families that help Hitler, but there are many, of course. Can you give us a quick overview of the biggest enablers and collaborators of Hitler?
Sure. From business, it was of those of contemporary relevance. It's the Quandt family, which controls BMW, which two heirs control BMW today, or the BMW Group, which oversees BMW, Mini, and Rolls-Royce. It's Friedrich Flick, who ran the largest steel and coal and weapons conglomerate during the Third Reich and ends up being convicted at Nuremberg. He's the only one, really, that gets convicted out of my main characters. Of course, you have families like Krupp and Thyssen, together today well known as the steel conglomerate ThyssenKrupp. Back then, there were two separate steel conglomerates, Krupp and Thyssen. And, you know, you have families like the Porsche-Pierre family. Of course, Ferdinand Porsche designs the Volkswagen for Hitler and also pushes out his Jewish co-founder, Adolf Rosenberger, from the Porsche car design firm. There is the von Finck family, which is a big insurance, financiers family, which founded Allianz and Munich Re, the largest insurers and reinsurers today. And there's the Oetker family, which actually was comparatively small to the others, but they were very ideological, where the main son, the main heir, joined the Waffen-SS and was trained at Dachau concentration camp.
You mentioned books about connection between big business and Hitler. One of the first books I read about the role big business played in the rise of Hitler was Hell's Cartel, about A.G. Farben, the chemical and pharmaceutical giant that was very instrumental, of course, in producing weapons in World War II. So what was striking for me in reading that book is that dinner on the 28th of February, the day after the fire in the Reichstag, that Hitler meets all the tycoons and bankers and gets a huge donation from A.B. Farben. I believe it was something like 400,000 Deutsche Mark. So is this the moment basically in which big business decided that they are betting on Hitler?
That's a prologue of my book, February 20th, 1933. It's when Hermann Göring, which Hitler's right-hand man, summons 22 dozen of Germany's wealthiest and most powerful industrialist financiers and executives, including two executives from IG Farben. And they're summoned to Göring's palace right next to the Reichstag. In the invitation that is sent per telegram, it is promised to these men that Hitler, the new chancellor, who of course seized power 3 weeks earlier, is going to explain his economic policies to these men. But nothing could be further from the truth. What it actually the entire meeting is about is a fundraise meeting for a Nazi party which is completely broke, has 12 million Reichsmark in debt, and needs money to stage their election campaign on March 5th, 1933. And both Hitler and Göring, in their speeches to the men, very explicitly promise to the assorted businessmen that this is going to be the last election that is going to happen in 10 or 100 years in Germany. So they very explicitly promised the end of German democracy.
Did they have any alternative at the time?
Yeah, I mean, they could have said no at this time. I mean, there probably would have been others that would have stepped in. They certainly could have said no. And some of the men actually ended up not donating.
Did they have any reason to think at that time that Hitler will become the most murderous dictator in the modern history?
No. What these men wanted was economic stability and political stability. They just had 14 years of economic instability in the Weimar Republic.
After World War One,
after
right?
World War One, exactly. Hyperinflation in the Weimar Republic, yeah. Economic instability, every year new government. And
like in Israel. Yeah,
exactly. And that's what Hitler promised them, is economic stability. And it started, of course, with rearmament from 1934 onwards. And billions were flowing to their coffers, and the Great Depression was ending, and it was an economic profitable time for them. Of course, then it slid quickly devolved into criminal behavior with the implementation of the Nuremberg race laws and the expropriation of Jewish-owned businesses and Jewish families, and then families in German-occupied territories, and then, of course, the mass exploitation of forced and slave labor during the war.
What was, at the end, driving the German business elite to support Hitler? Was it that at some point they understood that if he takes control, he will retaliate against those people that did not support him? Or did they think that he is the only candidate that can crush the communists, and at the end of the day, they rather have a dictator than lose some of their wealth under a communist regime?
That's a very interesting question. I mean, I think the reasons for them to support him was for most of them, I would say 90%, was opportunism. They offered, again, as I said, he offered economic stability. They wanted to protect at all costs their businesses, their fortunes, which had had a hit during the Great Depression. Their businesses were hanging on by a thread. And yeah, there was, as you rightfully say, they did see a big threat from communism and from the social democrats, but particularly from communism.
They saw what happened in Russia at
yes,
that time.
Exactly. And that was their worst nightmare.
In other words, the rich prefer a fascist dictator than giving away a power and wealth.
Yes, exactly. I mean, in a way, of course, they wanted to retain that. I mean, these were already families that were extremely wealthy during the German Empire, during the Weimar Republic, you know, and they stayed. I mean, in the end, my book is a story about the continuity of money and power over 150 years to today, you know, starting at the reunification of Germany in 1870. That's all they cared about. You know, these men, for the most part, were opportunists. And they saw an opportunity. They saw Hitler, in a way, as an investment. Once he had power, as well, this is the guy we're going to deal with. He promised us stability, and
so
that's what he initially
gives us.
Nothing
to do with the Nazis' ideology.
No, I mean, they were conservative. They were establishment conservatives. I mean, there's a few examples I give in the book. Some of my main characters were ideological Nazis, but they would make business. They were so convinced that they would make business decisions that went against their own businesses. They would merge a very profitable newspaper with a Nazi newspaper that was bleeding money because they were so convinced of Nazism. I mean, but those were the very few exceptions.
David, after World War II, the U.S. government move to crush cartel monopolies and big business in Japan and in the US. And many of the politicians and antitrust enforcer in the US read the history of the rise of Hitler as one that was associated with the concentration of power by the hands of a handful of big German companies. Now, do you share this reading of history that if you have very few large monopolies and cartels like AG Farben, they will move quickly to support an autocrat?
IG Farben is one of the very few examples of which at the time was the largest chemicals and pharmaceuticals conglomerate, which was broken up by the Allies. And I do think that having a company that is so dominant and too big to fail and that has a monopoly in a sense, but not only political, and it also has such political influence, I think it was a very wise idea for it to break up. I mean, look at how big the two companies that came out of IG Farben. One of them is Basf, still one of the largest chemical companies today, and the other one is Bayer, still one of the largest pharmaceutical companies today. You know, IG Farben was the Allies pictured this octopus of IG Farben with all its tentacles in everything, and it was true. So the decision to break it, I mean, in my opinion, they should have done it with more conglomerates, because in the end, IG Farben was an exception. Krupp and Flick and Thyssen and all the other steel magnates and industrialists and financiers could continue in West Germany by keeping in control of their companies and their conglomerates.
So what you're saying is that the U.S. Government quickly forgot or forgave the role of big business in Germany in the rise of Hitler. And after World War II, because, you know, they gave him a pass and started doing business with them, because business is business and the business of America is business.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, as soon as the Cold War emerges, Nazi Germany in 1947, early 1947, Nazi Germany and the Nazis are old history.
They even didn't change the brand name.
No.
They didn't need to.
No, in a way, no. They needed West Germany as a strong, economically strong, politically viable, democratic state as a buffer against the Soviet Union and, of course, the encroachment of communism on Western Europe in their fight against communism.
I know it's a difficult question, but who were the worst collaborators among the big business in Germany with Hitler, and how were they punished in any way?
I would say that those companies that had collaborations with concentration camps and with the SS, which are still some of Germany's largest companies today, were the worst kind of collaborators or had valued human life the least. So it is BMW with Dachau, it is the slave labor, IG Farben with Auschwitz. You know, I mean, it is really those major companies that are still Germany's largest companies today, or Daimler-Benz with Sachsenhauser, that I would say are the worst kind of collaborators, because they exploited concentration camp captives, which were really on the lowest bottom rung of the almost 12 to 20 million people that were deported from all across Europe into Germany to be
they forced to work at them.
Exactly. They were forced to work them, and at the lowest rung were, you know, Jewish concentration camp captives. In a very perverse sense, were lucky because they weren't immediately sent off to the extermination camps.
David, one interesting figure, I don't know if you spent much time looking into him and researching, actually, is Robert Jackson. He was the United States Solicitor General in the FDR government. And after World War II, he's appointed to be the Chief United States Prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials. So under FDR, he is the one that fights big business and monopolies, and then he is appointed to represent U.S. in Nuremberg trials. How critical were the Nuremberg trials in terms of big business and the role of big business in Germany in the rise of Hitler?
as the Cold War begins, the successive Nuremberg trials, or the ones that followed the main one, where of course 24 of Nazi Germany's the highest political and military figures were indicted and convicted. The successive trials, which are 12, includes 3 industrialist trials against Friedrich Flick and his associates, against Alfred Krupp and his associates, and against the entire executive board of IG Farben. They decided to only put the most well, either the biggest perpetrators or the most well-known symbolically on trial, because it could have been like the Quandt family in my book, which today controls BMW. The patriarch Günther Quandt could have easily also been one of those indicted in the Nuremberg industrialist trials. And, you know, it was for international law, and the Nuremberg trials were of huge importance for the actual persecution of German business that had committed crimes. It was, of course, a very tiny symbolic sliver that ended up being indicted and convicted, and of course were released after conviction within 5 years.
What was the reaction, if any, of German media to your book in the last couple of months?
The German translation of my book came out on May 5th, so about 6 weeks ago. And since then, I mean, it's been number one on the Zeit best list. It's on the Spiegel bestseller list today. It's getting a lot of attention and it's selling well. But so far, the families I write about and the companies I write about have given no reaction to my book. There is one exception. One of the reasons I wrote the book is because there's a BMW Foundation, Herbert Quandt. Herbert Quandt saved BMW from bankruptcy in 1959. And made his family the wealthiest. And today you have this foundation, which has this motto, inspire responsible leadership, on the basis that he saved BMW from bankruptcy, but leaves out the fact that he, you know, planned, that he designed, built, and dismantled a sub-concentration camp in Nazi-occupied Poland, that he had the responsibility over thousands of forced and slave laborers in Berlin battery factories, including hundreds of Jewish women from Auschwitz that were deported from Auschwitz and Sachsenhausen, that he used prisoners of war and forced labor at his own private estate, and that he bought a company stolen from Jews in France. And it was actually an Israeli guy that was got received money from that foundation. And after reading my book, he was, you know, outraged about having been lied to, that he's getting money in the name of a Nazi war criminal. So he, you know, he has kind of staged his intervention with the foundation, but now they're stuck between all these fellows that are furious about having been lied to by BMW, and this very conservative controlling shareholder of BMW, Stefan Quandt, Germany's richest heir, who also not only maintains a BMW foundation in name of his father, but also a media prize. And his sister, Susanne Klatte, who is Germany's richest woman, you know, receives a prize from the Jewish Museum in Berlin for her philanthropy. And it's being completely ignored that she does that in the name of her Nazi war criminal father.
David, do you expect some institutions will reconsider their positions and relationship with German big business that enabled Hitler, or this is all like water under the bridge 80 years after World War II? And do you think that German big business and the very wealthy families should acknowledge more their role in the rise of Hitler and in World War II, and do more in terms of apologize?
You know, my book ends in the Tel Aviv Museum of Art, where in December 2019, I went in and I saw two of the main families in my book among the donors at the Tel Aviv Museum of Art, Quandt and Flick. And I actually spoke yesterday with the head of publicity of Tama, and she was shocked because she had no idea that it was like the granddaughter of Magda Goebbels and, you know, the Flick family, which, of course, the patriarch was convinced at Nuremberg for war crimes against Jewish people, you know, that these were these families. You know, I think people should be aware of what the families have done that they receive money from. And, you know, to your second question, I think, you know, the whole point of the book, it's an argument in favor of historical transparency. If you're going to name, you know, global foundations, global media prizes, academic chairs, corporate headquarters after men that committed crimes during the Third Reich, you have to be at the very least, at the bare minimum, what consumers can expect is for these families to be transparent about the crimes they committed and not only celebrate their business successes. And, you know, I think that is at the very bare minimum, because you don't learn anything from history if you only show the good, you know. Then it's just a whitewash. And, you know, that is what my book is trying to address.
This is, I know, a very well-researched topic and very hotly debated in Germany and all over the world in the past 50 years. But what is your take on the role that existing German publishers played in the rise of Hitler and in supporting him?
It's a very interesting question, because there's a massive scandal going on right now in Germany about Henry Nannen, who is the publisher of Stern and of other, who was the publisher of Stern and the founder of Stern and other very famous German magazines. And there's a media prize named after him. And now it turns out he was part of the SS and he was also a war criminal. And they, you know, are now having this whole debate about renaming the Germany's biggest media prize, basically. But yeah, if you look at Bertelsmann, of course, it had its study published 20 years ago with Saul Friedlander, was one of the academics investigating it. If you compare what I think Reinhard Mohn was his name, the crimes that he committed as opposed to those that the families I write about did, he was pretty a small fish among in comparison to many of the families I write about. The publishing world, you know, it was, they were... And it's also the publisher that published my book, Holzbrink. You know, there's also a media prize named after Holzbrink, who was also published all these leaflets for the Nazis, just like Reinhard Mohn did as well. A lot of that has been known, has been published. They spread Nazi propaganda, but they didn't exploit forced and slave labor from concentration camps or at their own factory premises. They didn't mass produce weapons, and sometimes they did Aryanize, as it was called, expropriate the company of Jews.
So David, let's talk about not the past but the present. Is this book relevant today as it was like 50 and 80 years ago? Big business is still the most important political actor in many countries around the world. And of course, US comes to mind when we talk about democratic societies, and Russia when we talk about authoritarian regimes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's even more relevant today than it was 50, 30 or 80 years ago. You know, disinformation is rampant across the world, and the families that I write about not only are some of economically some of the world's most powerful families, but you know, the BMW Quants are also the largest donors to the Christian conservative CDU party, Angela Merkel's party in Germany. They're very much establishment conservatives. Stefan Quant sits on the board of the FAZ, which is Germany's leading conservative newspaper. So their influence is not limited to the world of business, but it also extends to the world of media and to politics. And particularly at a time, as I said, that disinformation has been so widespread globally, for families that have profited so much from the Third Reich and that are doing so much today to hide that history.
Let's stay in the present, David. You know, talk about the political power of corporations today and how that influence politics and the rise of specific politicians. Big business in the United States mostly liked Donald Trump's policies. They did not embrace him publicly, most of them. But very few companies and tycoons in the U.S. condemned Trump when he adopted, for instance, some of the very alarming racist language. Yeah.
No, I mean, the Muslim ban is a very good example. Like in January 2017, when he started, you know, banning people from certain countries traveling into the United States, you know, and there were mass protests, nobody on the National Business Council in the U.S. resigned. It was only that resignation started coming in after the Charlottesville protests of August 2017, when you had, in a way, eerily reminiscent of how Nazi troops marched in 1933 through Berlin. You know, you had these guys with their tiki torches at the campus of the University of Virginia to protect a statue of a Confederate general. And only after he was only after Trump said, "Oh yeah, both sides are right," or "we can't condemn the other side," mass resignation started coming in.
So, in your reading of history, what you're saying is that don't expect big business to stand in the way of autocratic, racist, or fascist leaders. They will not be the institutions in our societies today, and many even history can repeat itself, and the next autocratic leader will get the same support from big business.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it's
all about money.
It is the unfortunate truth, you know. I mean, if only business leaders globally were more informed by history and less informed by short-term profits, but the bottom line is money, and of course, the Trump era was hugely profitable for American corporations. But you know, we can take Russia as an example as well. You know, the devil's pact that many Russian oligarchs made with Putin, where they consolidated the power that they, or the assets that they had accumulated under Yeltsin and the Loans for Share program. You know, it's now 20 years later coming back to bite them. But of course, you know, it was a hugely profitable 25 years, 3 decades, 9 years under Yeltsin, and then 2 decades under Putin.
Do we have any moral heroes in the history of the rise of autocrats? I mean, big business that stood in the way, tried to stand in the way of those toxic and dangerous and murderous leaders?
I mean, not stand in the way. I mean, the examples, I would say, you know, I give one example of, I mean, of somebody who turned against Hitler, who was like one of Hitler's earliest supporters, Fritz Thyssen, and he, in 1939, he condemned the invasion of Poland by Germany, and he had to flee, and his steel conglomerate was expropriated.
By the way, Anat, if David mentions Thyssen, Thyssen, of course, is the company that is under a lot of scrutiny in the last 10 years for bribing many officials all over the world, including in the investigation into what happens with the Israeli submarines.
Yes, I've seen. It was Krupp, right? Wasn't that Krupp? Or it's ThyssenKrupp, of course.
ThyssenKrupp.
Now it's ThyssenKrupp. Now it's ThyssenKrupp. Back then it was Thyssen and Krupp separately. But exactly. It's ThyssenKrupp and the submarine scandal and the big bribery investigation, right? Yeah.
So, David, what is the next project?
Well, the next project is getting settled in Tel Aviv, in Israel.
It's a big project.
And exactly. And
perhaps you will, David, now that you settled in Tel Aviv, you should join us in investigating the political power of Israeli big business.
Yeah, I would love that. Go after the Ofers and the Wertheimers and after all the big... And the Benny Steinmetzes and of this world, sure.
Yeah,
I think I would first need to go to an Ulpan.
And the people who control media in Israel, as you know.
Yes,
they're
right,
also
right.
The
guy like that.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you so much, David, for taking
thank
the time
you,
to come here.
Thank you, Guy, for having me.
Have a good time in Israel.
Thank you very much. Toda rabba.
עד כאן המרקרים להשבוע, תודה רבה לדייוויד ג'ונג שהגיע לאולפננו, תודה רבה לאורחים שלנו, לדן ברומר, ולמפיק שלנו אמיר פקטור, תודה לחנת.
תודה גיא.
ולהתראות בשבוע הבא.